I think that he said everything correctly, because first I did some developing here. He said about, from the beginning, he said about aging causes suffering. First sentence. Second thing that he said about how is the growing up about the population, and he said about one of the most needed here that we need to see about health, about education, about social, and about, we need to see everything, but you are centralizing things in health. And then he said about the GDP, about the countries, what they use, that are huge things. And for me, about your question, about your seminar, about like that, what's the problem? For me, like, refer about health makers, the problems with them. Because this aging population, if they are in a hospital, if they are working, if they are nursing, they still provide the families. And why, for example, these health makers, maybe they cannot redistribute the money, the source, the funds. Exactly how we said about the chronic disease, because infection disease as malaria has been solved. And I think what I understood the problems with them. To try to do this.
Okay, so I guess there are a couple of answers to what you said. Mm-hmm. First of all, from the perspective of housing birth day, I am very much in favour of the application of very significant funds to the attempt to prevent death at early stages of life, in the developing world especially, from the major causes such as malaria. And indeed, it's extremely good that there are very wealthy individuals out there, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett and such like, who are putting vast amounts of money into supplementing, augmenting the government funding for challenging those things. But in the longer term, I think we have to acknowledge that it's important to not only to address inequality and to help the disadvantaged in the world, but also to, if you like, push forward the leading edge and to help people who we currently think of as nevertheless having a good inning. The other thing I want to say that covers a lot of the points you mentioned is with regard to public policy in response to the development of these therapies. Or to put it slightly more accurately, public policy in response to the arrival of widespread anticipation of these therapies. Because that's what's going to happen, you see. We're going to have, in my view, I think we have at least a 50-50 chance of developing these therapies within perhaps 25 years, but I think we have a 50-50 chance or more of developing proof of concept of these therapies in the laboratory, typically in mice, within less than 10 years. And that's when the pandemonium is really going to happen, when people's priorities are going to change. Now, the good news is that the public debate on all of this is going to be, well, first of all, rather rapid, but also it's going to take into account the consequences for longevity. And that means that people's expectation of how long they're going to live is going to rise very rapidly. That is the really important difference between what we'll see then and what we've seen, let's say, in the past 50 years. In the past 50 years, life expectancy has been increasing, but it's only been increasing very gradually. And a lot of people sort of don't really notice that it's been increasing at all. If you ask them how long they're going to live, they'll typically give you an answer that resembles how old their grandparents were when they died. So the reason that's important is because gradual change is the politician's worst enemy. Essentially, when something's changing gradually, you can end up in a situation where public policy really ought to change, but the balance of power of vested interests pretty much always tends to lie with the status quo. So it's incredibly hard to do anything with, for example, the statutory retirement age. But when things are changing very suddenly, when there are dramatic changes and everybody sort of knows that we're not in Kansas anymore, it's not like that. Politicians can get away with being statesmanlike and actually saying, hello, we've got to redesign such and such a thing from the ground up. We saw this with the credit crunch a couple of years ago. Suddenly, trillions of dollars that nobody even knew could exist were spent, and nobody really complained very much. You know, so I'm not too worried about it.
Hey, first of all, in terms of thinking about mass growing populations, do you see the side effects of the side effects of longer life as compatible with a sustainable planet, or do you see it as irrelevant?
Well, I addressed that to some extent in my remarks. I mean, I do think that it's very important that we should maintain the global population at a stable level, a level that's sustainable. Of course, the level that is sustainable changes with time as technology comes on stream that allows more people to be packed in with an unchanged quality of life. But that change is relatively gradual, and I don't think that it's going to be the whole answer. However, even ignoring that, even if we make the pessimistic assumption that there is an absolutely fixed maximum carrying capacity of the Earth and that technology doesn't change that number, we still have the choice between a high death rate or a low birth rate. At the moment, we have a high death rate, like I told you, 150,000 a day. And two-thirds of those deaths are from aging. They are from causes that young adults pretty much never die of. In the West, in the industrialized world, it's like 90% of all deaths are due to aging. Okay. So it's fairly clearly humanity's worst problem. Now, if we develop therapies that can fix that problem, then yes, it's certainly the case that in the very long term, there will be the need to bring the birth rate down to something comparable to the newly reduced death rate in order to avoid continued global population increase. But we do not know whether that is going to be considered acceptable or not by humanity of the future. It may very well be that humanity of the future decides that that's actually fine. Now, one thing that I like to point out that's above this question is the issue of children that haven't been born yet or haven't even been conceived yet. Okay. Now, certainly we can say that everyone that has been born has equal human rights, and of course we can argue then about fetuses and so on of certain ages. But when it comes to children that have not been conceived, it's pretty obvious that we have, again, voted with our feet. That they don't matter very much. You know, when someone challenges me on this, my typical answer is to ask three questions. They say, how many children have you got? And they'll say, like, one. And I'll say, okay, how many children could you have had by now if you had put your mind to it? And the answer is, of course, larger. And then I say, the third question is, how dare you? To deprive all these hypothetical people of life. Right? So we're already doing exactly that already. It's fairly clear that from a moral perspective, we have clearly come to the decision that future unconceived people don't matter very much.
My question is really whether the treatments are paid for by the individual or through the state by sort of an NHS type system or something. Somebody's going to have to pay the taxes for that, so surely we're left with the second point of Brian, that we're still working forever to pay that. Anyway.
Right, so I don't think that Brian is precisely correct in saying that there will be no retirement anymore. I think, however, that retirement will certainly be periodic. It will be a case of, you know, you'll work for 40 years as a professor or whatever, and then you'll retire for 10 years on your savings or on the state pension or whatever. But, you know, if you're still biologically 25 or 30, then by 10 or 20 years out, golf will have lost its novelty value. You will probably want to do something else with your life. So there will be a very clear commitment by society to increase the investment in adult education and retraining so as to give people another career, a different career. And of course there will be benefits, touching on another thing that Brian mentioned, from actually making this happen, from actually structuring the economy and society and tax incentives and so on, to encourage people not to stay in the same job for more than a certain number of decades. You know, I don't think really that any of these problems, when one actually looks at the details, are even slightly difficult. There are loads and loads of different alternative ways to restructure the way the economy would work, so that the dependency ratio, the number of people in work divided by the number of people not in work, remains manageable.
I'm only sitting back, but I'm not heckling from the back.
Not yet.
I noticed in your talk, you talked about the development of regenerative medicine taking decades, and then subsequently you mentioned your imaginary 1,000-year-old person. And you also mentioned God. So muddling those things up together, and as soon as you mentioned God, I thought about Darwin, and wondered if you would like to speculate about the walloping environmental change that an 1,000-year lifespan would bring to Homo sapiens, and how you feel about the evolution of humans in the future, and perhaps develop a new home called Homo senescens.
Yeah, so a simplistic interpretation of what the defeat of aging would do for the evolution of humanity is that it would slow down, because there would obviously be less turnover, fewer children per unit of time being born, that's basically a slowing of the process. But actually I think that exactly the opposite is going to happen, that evolution will massively speed up. And the reason that's going to happen, the main reason it's going to happen, is because a good number of the therapies that we're going to have to develop in order to pull this off will involve somatic gene therapy, will involve the modification of the genetic composition of organisms, of human beings that are already alive. And once we can do that for medical purposes to prevent various of the diseases of old age, we'll also be able to do it in whatever other way we want to do it, for whatever other reason. So we will be much more in control of the direction and in the rate of our evolution, and I very strongly suspect that that will speed up immensely. So there's not much about God in all that, but yeah, not much about Darwin either. Karen's getting older, she's not running out of bed.
I just wondered what you thought about the implications for human beings' mental resilience of this much longer lifespan. If you're going to live with someone for 300 years of that life, the impact of losing a parent or a loved one when you're 50 or 70 is massive. What about the people who've been living for 300 years? Are we really able to cope with that?
It's a problem I'd like to have. I'm not enjoying my mother being sick right now, but I wouldn't enjoy myself being sick either. And, if I can prevent one, that's good.
This planet does have a finite number of resources, and given the finite number of resources, even if there was a radical restructuring of the way those resources are distributed, what that would mean with that many people on the planet would be a vastly reduced lifestyle for everyone.
So this is what
I mean. How many people in this room are interested in living a vastly reduced lifestyle, having been brought up to believe that in this postmodern world, the world is our oyster, and we are deserve to get what we get.
So kick the microphone. So, as you may have heard, I have already addressed the question of overpopulation very directly and very carefully by saying that we do indeed need to control the population. I'm quite sure that you were not asleep when I answered those questions. So rather than simply repeating the question, which is what you've just done, I would like you to tell me what you think is wrong with the answers I gave.
Because you didn't directly address what life would look like.
If what I say is going to happen,
then number of resources.
Right, I told you that the overpopulation question needs to be addressed by keeping population from becoming overpopulation. In other words, by matching the death rate to the birth rate. Now, tell me what the resource problem is if we do that.
Well, there's currently a resource problem
right now.
So, given the problem right now, doesn't it make sense to move forward in terms of making this world more equitable,
sure,
creating social justice and economic justice for the people who live here?
I completely agree. And I think that the birth rate should be reduced right now, before we get these therapies to reduce the death rate. I was privileged to have a debate about 2 or 3 years ago with Jonathan Porritt, the person who founded Friend of the Earth. and he was very generous in completely destroying his own argument by revealing that a number of people in Friends of the Earth, who were Friends of the Earth, have voluntarily decided not to have any kids so as not to harm the environment. The fact is that having a kid is the most environmentally unfriendly thing you can possibly do.
That's very true. But let's go back to, given a finite number of resources, if resources are redistributed equally on the planet, how many people in this room would like to live a vastly reduced lifestyle for 1,000 years?
Distributing resources equally is, of course, a very different question from the question of how many people the resources are distributed between. Now, as I mentioned earlier in response to the question about malaria, I completely agree that it's absolutely vital to develop ways to improve the quality of life of the most disadvantaged people in society. But that does not mean, I don't see anybody suggesting, that they should indeed reduce their own quality of life to that level now. Any more?
I wanted to address, I think, the point you make about intellectual dishonesty, because I can see myself kind of falling into the category of the intellectually dishonest, insofar as a degree of skepticism about there being any step change or revolutionary change in medical technology. What we do know from looking at the history of attempts to promote longer lives is there has been a succession of people who have offered a solution to this problem, who, however well-intentioned, in the kind of hindsight of history, can be seen to be basically creating a sort of a fantasy science fiction for which many intelligent people bought into.
Yeah, so.
And I guess that the consequence then is this notion of this radical change. Is there any empirical evidence for any radical change or having any current medical benefits in contrast to the false dawns that have existed for probably several hundred years, in contrast to an alternative incrementalist position which says that we are aware that life expectancy is increasing, not just life expectancy at birth, but also life expectancy at the age of 60. And a lot of this is to do with incremental changes, both medical, technological, social, and economic, which suggests that it may be some time in the future, which we don't know where the end will be, but it is not the same as offering, if you like, a semi-miraculous step change transformation which will completely eradicate the possibility of growing older.
Right. So, The concept of empirical evidence for the feasibility of pioneering technological development is a very different concept than the concept of empirical evidence as used in basic science when we're trying to test hypotheses. So, you know, if we ask what evidence did the Wright brothers have in 1902 that their design for a plane would actually work, they didn't. They had to actually build the thing and see. But the other point that really is critical insofar as we do want to point to some sort of empirical evidence in answering your question, is we can look at past technologies like power of light, and we can see very clearly that the trajectory of what we can do does not track linearly or proportionally with the trajectory of what we know. Knowledge about what was necessary for power of flight was growing incrementally since Leonardo da Vinci, or before. Okay? And lo and behold, it would have no effect and no effect and no effect. We were inching from there. We still could only get as high as we could jump. And then suddenly, we had a hard takeoff, at a point where the technology fitted together well enough that it actually worked, and suddenly we had power of flight. It's a sort of step function. So step functions are normal in technology. Now, when the step function is going to occur, when the fundamental breakthrough is going to occur, is absolutely not easy to predict. I absolutely want to emphasize what I said early on, that I only predict a 50-50 chance that we're going to develop this decisively comprehensive maintenance for aging within 25 years. I think there's at least a 10% chance that we won't get there for 100 years. OK? Okay, very speculative on the time frame. But the idea that we are that there is at some point going to be this step function going from this very, very, very slow increase in longevity to suddenly indefinite longevity, that, I think, is pretty much an inescapable consequence, inescapable conclusion from what we already do know about the way biology works.
Thank you both very much for your presentations. It was a real pleasure to listen to both of your talks.
Thank you.
I'd just like to ask, are all of us who are going to be living such vastly longer lives, are we going to be living in some sort of mono middle class? I think we should get out of our ivory towers and think about those living far below the poverty line, and are we suggesting that we extend this, and perhaps we need to be thinking more about the social reform that Brian talked of?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's absolutely right. But I don't think it's an either-or. I think that the challenges facing society in addressing the problems that you emphasise are so different from the challenges facing society in developing technology against aging that there is no competition between the two. They should definitely both be addressed. Thank you.